Welcome to the Near Post Local, where too much football or futsal is never likely to be enough. Football in the capital region. I'm Peter Funnell. The men's and women's Premier League football competitions are rapidly drawing to a close, and most of the positions for the finals are now established, with a couple of fringe teams in each case madly scrambling. What is pleasing is that there's a real chance of substantial surprises across the Premier League grades when it comes to grand final time. But it would be remiss of me not to draw your attention to two prizes that really should be well regarded. The first of those is the real indicator of good performance in Premier League football, the club championship. That is, the points earned over the season across all the Premier League grades. That speaks as no other prize to the health of a club. And there is the other important one, the Premiership. I don't mean the grand final winner, I mean the Premiership. The team which came first after all the rounds of competition were completed before the finals commenced. This latter prize is, in my view, the true measure of a winning team. A whole of season effort, with all its ups and downs, no wonder Sir Alex Ferguson prizes the EPL Premiership above all others. But we do like our grand finals, and we're in for some very entertaining ones. Tonight, as promised, we continue with part two of our interview series with Ron Smith, football analyst extraordinaire, a true national football treasure. There's been nothing but terrific feedback from interview number one. Ron has been commissioned by Capital Football to conduct a comprehensive review of the high performance program. If you liked part one, and it sounds to me like a lot of people did, you will definitely like part two. It's even better. As Ron says, are you serious? Good question. Here we go to Ron Smith.
Like I say, it's progress. We've now got to the point where, regardless of who's doing it, we've got a national curriculum, we've got a national development plan. And all of that means that you want to do more.
Yes.
You want to start the identification process a lot earlier. You need time to try and develop technical ability, but you don't have to coach it.
Yeah.
You see, a lot of people think that I've got to actually teach somebody something.
Yeah.
The best thing that you can do with young kids is to actually let them have fun and you organise it.
This All is right. this letting the game be the teacher, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's yeah, a bit of a that's a little bit of a cliche.
Bit cliche, yeah.
Because if that's the case, then we never need coaches anywhere.
But there has to be intervention. Yeah.
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 It's how you do it and when do you do it and how much of it.
Yep.
But the key fact is this: you cannot teach touch. All right. You can teach an action.
Yeah.
And you can say to somebody, "Look, okay, look, the reason you're screwing it left is because your body position's totally unstable and you need to do certain things to improve your stability."
This will be interesting to some players.
And all that sort of
all
stuff.
All players.
You know, like, whenever you try... Well, there's all sorts of things. If you strike a ball and your centre of gravity is over your non-kicking foot, which is what happens in most cases, if you don't maintain stability of your upper body, you'll either hook it left, bend some right, hit some straight, but you won't know which one because you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
To maintain now, if once you know how to maintain stability, then you can drive the thing as hard as you want, and you'll get a much tighter target area that you hit consistently.
But you're saying it's biomechanics. You can't teach touch.
You can't teach touch. No. So if you go to a golf course, you go to a golf course, you go to a basketball centre.
Yeah.
What do you see kids doing? You see them around the D or outside the circle going for three pointers.
Correct.
And they practice and they practice and they practice. Why? Well, the difference between it and the backboard, 4 inches behind the ring, means you're miles away. You've got to hit just over the front lip. It's got to hit the back of that ring or go in without touching the ring completely.
Yeah.
That's fine-tuned stuff.
Yep.
Anyone could put it somewhere near the ring.
Yeah.
But it's the ones that can get it in there without touching it, 8 times out of 10. You can't teach that. You have to develop it. And the way you develop it is through repetition.
Yes.
It's the same thing with kicking a ball. If you said to me, okay, chip a ball so it lands on the goal line from the edge of the box, and now chip one so it's halfway up the goalpost, and now chip one so it hits the crossbar.
Mm.
I can't tell you how hard I'm going to kick it. You look at it, and from the million odd times or 10 million odd times that you've kicked a ball, your brain computes it. Yeah. It's like putting.
Yes.
You know, what's the difference between a 6 foot downhill left right breaking putt and one that's, you know, 10 feet? And those, it's that feeling.
And those massive, yes.
So when you see young golfers, they're all around the greens chipping,
yep.
putting. It's the soft, it's the touch, it's the feel. It's no difference to clipping a ball into the near post that's got to be head height or trying to put it in there and it goes 3 feet too high.
Yeah.
If you can't deliver the one that's just right, your touch has let you down.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to your earlier point, this high-performance program process that is the subject of this review and is now sort of coming out of this curriculum, it's the way forward, starts early, so the habits...
You're trying to develop early, those.
And you're giving time for that repetition to occur. So those neural pathways get laid down, and it's more the art than the science a lot of the time, isn't it?
Absolutely. But you see, the thing, it's like, do people go out and learn how to build a house? Or do they, we have carpenters, first of all, what do they do? Well, they put all the framework up, they have techniques. I know things have changed these days because of speed and efficiency. You don't have chippies now cutting joints out and... You know, but what I'm saying is, it's the tools of the trade.
Yeah, correct.
Now, in some positions in the game, you need finely tuned skills. In other areas, maybe not quite so much, but you still need, because the game is evolving and changing, the demands of players at top level these days are all-inclusive. You've got to be pretty good at most things.
Yeah.
I'm not saying centre-backs have to be able to nutmeg people and dribble, because, you know, but they need to be comfortable when challenged in 1v1.
Yep.
How do you then keep possession, keep the ball out of tackling range, so I don't get I don't lose the ball and so on. I'm able to evade things without losing it and without panicking.
Yeah,
you know, instead of just going welly up the park. So what I'm saying is, there's more and more evidence now tells you that the centre backs have more ball contact than any other player on the field.
Yeah,
with the exception of Xavi, who plays for Barcelona and Spain. He's the one who defies the odds. But the centre-backs at Barcelona have more play than their midfielders.
Yeah, the redistribution of the ball.
Because the game's changing.
Yes,
so they now have to be, you know, really, really good technicians.
Yeah.
Don't have to be good dribblers.
Yeah.
But they've got to be very, very comfortable on the ball. So what do your junior programmes play? Sort of like start to instill.
Mm.
If you're still getting your centre-backs to welly up the park, you're doing the kids a disservice.
Yeah, it's interesting.
That don't mean to say you don't do it.
Yeah. But it's not. It's
there's
not,
a time and place for everything.
Yes.
And that's part then of learning to play the game.
Yes. It's interesting you say that, because the Australian under 13 boys and girls coaches each said that the hardest positions they had to fill from that galaxy of young talent were those two centre back positions.
Yeah.
And they both found themselves, if I can put it this way, as kindly as I can, recycling midfielders. Yeah. into those positions, because they are looking for that skill set you're talking about, this high rate of contact on the ball.
Exactly.
The game has changed, clearly.
Look, when I became the head coach at the AIS in 1986, I sort of said publicly, we're going to force people to play the ball out, because if we can't change that aspect of our game at the national level, we're never really going to make significant progress in international football.
Yeah.
Because it was our biggest weakness.
Yeah.
And I did exactly the same. There were, I mean, people might know more locally. Kevin Muscat was always a midfield player. Yep. I converted Kevin to play at the back.
Yeah.
Ned Zelic.
Yeah.
I only found out years later, it was a striker until I actually brought him into the AIS, where he played mostly as a midfield player. But then I suggested to Ned, let's start getting you playing at the back.
Mm.
He's played most of his career at the back and in midfield.
Mm.
Josip Simenic was probably the most skillful player I've ever had the pleasure of working with as a kid.
He's nice to watch when he plays.
Ah, he was just unbelievable. But for different reasons, I said to Joe, you need to play at the back. You can have a major influence on the game.
And because he does.
He's had a fabulous career in Europe and World Cup, and unfortunately didn't play for Australia, but that's another story. But, you know, what I'm saying is that you know, we're now, but there are other qualities that you need to play at the back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a certain element of basics, like being able to compete in the air. Because the ball's always going to be in the air at some stage.
Yes.
So it's no good having your back line at 5'8".
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
You know,
yeah.
You come up against the boy Zigic that we played for Serbia, who's 6'8", and he's going to win more than you will.
He's just got to stand there,
isn't
he?
Exactly, yeah. Well, so, you know, but so that's how things evolve, and we've done that to a certain degree, and we'll continue to keep trying to do it.
Okay, so I guess the message for the listener here is, this review is very much about how we can go forward from where we are.
Absolutely.
Keep the good things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Dispose and or replace the things that just aren't working right.
Maybe some subtle changes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been asked to make some recommendations.
Yeah.
Which I would like to think I'll be in a position to do. But they have to be realistic.
Mm.
It's no good me saying, oh, well, we need this, let's build another synthetic field here and we'll have all the training and really good lighting conditions.
Yeah.
I might make a recommendation to say that wouldn't it be wonderful if one day, say inside the next 10 years, we had another 5 fully lit, flood lit synthetic fields in the ACT for all sorts of reasons, like taking the pressure off the playing surfaces for competition.
Yeah.
So that when the Premier League teams play, they actually have every week a really nice surface to play on.
Oh, look,
that will do wonders to motivate coaches and players.
Absolutely.
And raise the standard.
We were speaking off air. The best thing that's happened in terms of grounds and the ACT and the as long as I can remember, is the introduction of the Hawker Tiger Turf synthetic surface.
Yeah.
Just been sensational.
Couldn't agree more.
I opened a lot of people's eyes, including mine, I can tell you.
Yeah.
But look, I wanted to ask you something else about football in these age groups that are covered by this high performance program.
Mm.
I think it's something that parents are grappling. It certainly has its effect on coaches and their availability and the resources that you can commit. Football has really become a whole of a year sport. Just about. Pretty much gone are the days, I think, when you put your football boots out in the cupboard after the last game and found your cricket whites or something and went off. All the big sports are now seeking to retain their athletes, their participants, players, whatever you want to call it, for the best part of the year.
Well, Peter, you hit on something that is dear to my heart.
Yep.
The first year I spent in Australia was in 1974.
Mm.
And I can remember the Sunday morning I drove to the local milk bar to get the milk and papers. And I went home and I said to my wife, you won't believe what I've just seen. I said, there's people in white gear everywhere you look. They're all over the parks and there's thousands of them. And I'd never seen anything like that. Because where I grew up in London, I actually never ever saw a cricket match. I didn't know. There were no cricket clubs where I grew up. I saw cricket on the telly and I played it at school.
Yeah.
Poorly, I became a great gymnast from playing cricket. Okay, because the ball was never hit out the boundary, and I couldn't throw it back anyway. So we practiced all our cartwheels and handsprings and headstands.
That's right. Yeah.
And about once every 20 minutes, the ball came near you.
That's right.
That's why I hate cricket with a passion.
Yeah, you had a lot of time to think.
It was poorly taught. But anyway, that's another story. But
I'm sorry to the cricketers.
Yeah. No offense to cricket, but you know, each to their own. I say. But the thing is, it's the 6-month mentality.
Yeah.
Now, when people go overseas, what they see is a football mentality and a football culture, where football's played for 9 to 10 months of the year minimum.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's
and you have a little break, and that's why they play cricket in England.
Yeah.
It's just something to do between the football seasons. People in Australia didn't believe me when I told them that. When I used to come here and England would get battered by Lily and whatnot in the cricket, I used to say, but no one takes it seriously in England.
Oh.
That was my perspective living in London.
Well, this is reinforced.
If I'd come from Yorkshire, I'd have been beaten to death with a bit of 4x2.
That's true.
Yeah. But anyway, so the 6-month mentality was killed when we went to summer football in 89.
Yeah.
Because it meant then that we had there were other reasons why we went to summer football, but it actually gave a much better environment for people to train and play in with better surfaces.
Yeah.
And it also meant that now people are going to have to start saying, well, hang on a minute, this is going to go for this amount of time and we're going to make it longer and longer each year gradually. Mm. So we actually had environments then where young kids could grow up and play all year round.
Mm.
So in the youth bracket, in the teenage years, for the better players who were starting to get serious, they could play all through the summer with high-performance programs, and they could play all through the winter with their clubs.
Mm.
Now, you might say, well, when did they have a rest? Yes, they had a break, because people are sensible, you know, and at which ages.
Yeah.
But the important bit about developing talent is that you have to do it regularly.
Yeah, you do.
Every day, every week. Well, maybe not every day, but, and there are ways of being able to do it every day that are quite simple. But you can't have 4 months off and expect to then pick it up and like turning water on out of a tap. You've got it, and that's where you develop touch, because you can't teach touch.
You know, Ron,
it's logical, it's easy to understand.
Yeah.
So if you want to produce good players, the formula is simple.
Yeah. Well, could I just take you to swimming? We're talking off air about swimming.
Yeah.
If we say that the kids that are swimming competitively in the high performance level, not entirely dissimilar to young kids playing football in the high performance, try telling the head coach at any of our top swim clubs, look, I'm going to take 4 months off, you know, to play cricket or do underwater macrame or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, that just wouldn't compute.
No.
And he'd give you no chance at all of hitting your targets at the next competitive round.
You know what you say there? Are you serious?
Are you serious? Yes.
We come back to that magical... Are you serious?
Are you serious?
Do you think that for 1 minute you're going to be, you know, swimming in the national team and you want 4 months off?
Yeah, not going to happen. Break. Not going to happen.
Go and, you know, do whatever.
Well, you see, this is, I think, something that takes parents by surprise when their child demonstrates some ability and they get on this pathway.
Mm.
And it's early days.
Yeah.
If there are big breaks, to pick up your point, these kiddies are growing, and all at different rates, age-relevant effect, all that sort of
Absolutely.
Stuff. And a coach has to be able to observe and deal with that on an ongoing basis. They drop out, it's harder to get it going again.
Kids are, they're mini adults in a way.
Yeah.
Adults can do things for long periods of time, every day or whatever. Mm. But even now and again you go, gee, I could do a week off.
Yeah.
I need a break from this or whatever. I want to do something else.
Mm.
I've hit a stalemate. I've hit a plateau in technical jargon. And kids are no different. That doesn't mean to say they won't come back to it.
No.
And sometimes coaches have to be, and parents have to be sensitive to a kid who wants to try something else for a little while. Doesn't mean you say they're going to abandon the game or, you know, whatever.
But you need to be able to manage that, don't you?
Absolutely. Common sense is probably the best way of doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I encourage my kids to play all sorts of sports.
Yeah.
Particularly because I was heavily involved in football or soccer at an elite level. I didn't want them to feel they were compelled to do it. You know, my eldest son in particular is an extremely talented sportsman. He was a super swimmer, could play tennis, played international junior national team volleyball, 2 years ahead of his time and whatnot. They're both keen golfers. Barney played football a bit more. But, you know, so what I'm saying is they were given encouragement to go and play other sports.
Yeah.
I won't say cricket. I didn't really encourage because I didn't want to kill them. But anyway, you know, so what I'm saying is, but they still, you'll invest your time and effort.
Mm.
Because you look back in the old days, when I grew up, they didn't have any programs.
No.
They didn't have any coaches.
No.
Okay. No. And yet...
No.
But one thing is, we still produced top quality players. Now, a little bit of coaching, as I found out in my late teens, when I suddenly actually met somebody that I then realised...
goes a long way.
This guy is what they call a coach.
Yeah.
I'd never had one before.
Yep.
And then I knew the difference between a trainer and a coach. Yep. And that interested me so much, it got me on the pathway.
Can I ask you this? In this age group again, in this high performance issue, I know we're sort of travelling around this in a way, but it's all a coherent subject.
Yeah.
At some point, the player, if they want to pursue football, has to really make some decisions, obviously with parental support. It really doesn't work. And these age groups doesn't work real well without it.
Yeah.
In fact, it's quite impossible, really. At some point, the other interests drop off to the side and the emphasis goes just ever so much more into football.
Yeah.
And this is where we get into this regime of, you know, going from summer to winter in a continuous way. Perhaps the emphasis and content changes.
Yeah.
But what age do you think that sort of happens?
It varies.
Yeah.
It varies. I've spoken to players who've gone on to play professional football all their life.
Yeah.
And I've asked some of them, when did you ever start to think that either maybe you wanted to do it, maybe you did that early in your life?
Yeah.
And I've had mixed responses, mixed answers. Some have said, well, yeah, I always sort of dreamed about it as a kid, under 10, age, whatever.
Mm.
And others have said to me, I never really even thought about playing football as a professional athlete until you invited me to come to the AS.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I suddenly realised, well, if I'm here with the best 18 or 20 kids in the country, I'm probably better than I think. I never thought that this had happened to me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know how good I might have been or was. Yeah. I never really thought about it because I had nothing to measure it against. I just play football because I love playing the game. And now you're telling me that I've been selected to come into a high-performance, high-profile programme. And I've got a chance of playing for the national youth team.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a shock to some. And then when I used to say to them, look, the evidence tells me half of you in 3 years' time would probably be playing international football and half of you won't. And that used to scare them even more because, funnily enough, Mark Viduka said this to me 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
He said, I'll never forget that first time you spoke to us as a group and said, 10% of you are going to be in the youth team. And I said, well, actually it was 50%. But he said, oh, was it? He said, well, I couldn't remember. But he said, I remember you saying, and all I could think of, I want to be in that then.
Yeah.
I want to be in that percent.
Yeah.
And he said, I said to myself then, I'm not going to waste a minute because you said, you can't wake up to this 6 months into the first year because you might have missed the boat by then.
Yeah. And the reason I'm pursuing you about this is because given the pathway for the talented player, as it sort of is at the moment, and if we sort of look at the Joeys at being the, you know, one big target to hit, but between that and a young child that comes in at under 11s and 12s into the Capital Football High Performance Program, that high performance program, my guess is, has got to be a bit porous because it's got to be able to take girls and boys in and out
with
all those things that influence them. So you're trying to make it easy for people to come in and give them reasons to stay.
Absolutely. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that because at some point, this high-performance program has to hand part of its product, or its product, its outcomes, over to two parties. One is to ACTAS, where they're trying to harvest the best in the boys. It's a narrow band, it's the 15s and 16s essentially, and the girls it's a bit more wider,
it's a broader age range because of that's what happens. You'll get young girls at 16 playing in the national team.
Absolutely. It's a really different situation there. They can see kids galloping away, and then that small group that you spoke about at the AIS, then that's the next jump out of the NTC, ACTAS and its equivalents around the snow. Yeah. Boy, doesn't this pyramid really narrow down?
It does, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And, I mean, you're absolutely right. Without them, we'd never know how good kids are.
No, that's right.
And if we didn't have them, what would parents say?
Oh, that's a good question.
They'd be saying, do you know, it's a crying shame. Yeah. Look how good some of these kids are.
Yeah, that's it.
There ought to be some programs where they can actually keep kicking on, and you never know, one of these kids might play for Australia one day.
Yep, and I'm thinking, I'm thinking, Ron, that one of the key handover points for our high performance program, obviously, you say the same thing in any state, has to be that handover point between the high performance program and or ACTAS and at that age group, the Premier League clubs in the ACT, because that's the two outlets, isn't it?
Yeah.
We want them to keep playing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So all the time, whilst you're still trying to develop at the lower end of the scale, and kind of like provide people with the right sort of information and direction that's applicable at that age and at that time.
Yeah.
You still want to try and drive what's happening at the top.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is why, you know, the facility then becomes, what's the training facility like?
Yeah, this is it.
How motivated are the players? Well, they'll be greatly influenced by the environment that they go to train in.
Correct.
If that's a bit ordinary, even terrible, you're not going to get a good feedback and response out of the players.
No, I don't think you will either, mate.
It's like saying, well, I'm going to go swimming down the IOS pool. I can't see the bottom because it's so bloody clogged up and dirty.
That's right.
You know. But if you go in and it's pristine and everything else and there's lovely lighting and it's a nice temperature, you go, I'm coming here every night.
They're
all
on notice. Yeah.
Exactly. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And football, and well, it's like, you know, people turn up in their office. Do they want a clean desk? Do they want to see a pair of dirty football boots on there from last night's training? You go, hang on, they shouldn't be in here. This is my desk.
Yeah.
I want it kept as I like.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the environment at work, got pictures on the wall. Do you want to work in a room with no windows like we are right now? Yeah. But, yeah, studio. But, you know, so what I'm saying is that it impacts on everybody who wants to become better. Yeah. Now, the guys in the Premier League know by now they're not going to play for Man United.
That's it, yeah.
But they still want to play to the best of their ability and compete with other people who are of a similar standard week in, week out under the best possible conditions they can muster.
Absolutely.
Because they love playing the game.
Absolutely right. And if anyone had been at Hawker and watched that cracking good game between Woden Valley and Canberra City in lashing rain in the middle of a storm, there was no doubt the two teams were real keen on getting an outcome. And as were all the spectators and the club officials. That was just as important as anything else that was going on.
Yeah.
But a lot of those players that were out there have gone through these development programs. A lot of them.
Before we leave that, there was a second part to your question that I didn't answer and I'd like to. And that was about, you used the word, I think, handover.
Yeah, just a handover point.
I think I was a kid once and I can remember playing with my mates and it was a great social environment to be in. There'd be the odd stranger come in because someone had said, he's a good player, this lad.
You know,
we'll everyone tries to recruit good players.
We're all on the lookout for that. Okay. Yeah.
So then, and slowly they become part of the team and you get to know them and, you know, and they become a mate in the end and so on. But we all wanted to play representative football. Okay. I knew when I went to high school, there weren't any representative teams until under 15. That was the only one. And I actually never played 11-a-side football until I went to high school. First time I ever played on well, I played one game at primary school. Right. I'll tell you some funny stories about that, but not now. But I could juggle a ball, I could bend it, chip it, shoot, do whatever, because I'd only ever played in the park. All right. And I'm not saying I was perfect, but I had a good range of technique. I could dribble and do all sorts because you just went over there and you did what you did. In those days, if you had a game with another bunch of kids and you were giving them a bit of a battering, one of the older kids would say, here, you go on the other team, you do this, you do that, and even it up. A little bit of a tangent that, but what I'm saying is this handover thing. There is a point where you want people to keep contact with their social groups, and so they come in and out of, if you like, high-performance programs.
Yes.
Now, there comes a point then where you say, well, if you're going to be serious, is that word again, you need more high-performance training than playing with your mates. So at some stage, you basically got to make a choice.
Yeah, that's true.
And it happens to everybody at every level.
Yeah.
And there comes a point in, and it's like changing from primary school to high school. You know, some people have a preference going to a school. But your mates are going to this one. Well, but I want to go to that one, or my parents do as well. So I'll still see my mates after school and at the weekend. But I know I'll make new friends here and so on. And football, any sport, is just the same. So there comes a point where a professional club offers you a contract.
Yes.
So what do? Do you stay playing for Belcon and United? Or do you go to Sydney and sign for Sydney FC? I'm going to leave all my mates at Belcon and United. And they'll all say, you're an idiot if you don't. Give me half a chance, I'll take your place. Because everyone acknowledges that you're not going to take the whole team. If there's one out of this club or one out of this district that get an opportunity, then he's the lucky one.
Yeah, grab it with both hands.
Exactly. And that don't stop all the others from still trying.
No.
And some might actually be even motivated to do a little bit more serious training and make the transition 12 or 18 months later.
Yeah.
Because they say, I reckon I'm as good as him, a lot easier. So there's a chance for me yet. And so you get late development. He may have got a great chance because he was in a particular position in the right place at the right time, which is one of the biggest factors that affects the signing of players.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Because clubs look at what they need.
Yeah, that's
what it comes down to. And so they, you know, and they'll go around and say, well, he's a fabulous striker, but we don't need a striker.
No, we've got three of them.
I need a left back.
Yeah.
And so the left back might be number four choice in the Belconnen United team, but it'll be the first choice in the Sydney FC youth team.
Yeah. And if he's got a left foot, I'm really interested.
Absolutely. You see, so what I'm saying is it's not just about ability. It doesn't mean to say then that the striker who thinks that he's as good as him can't get a contract in Adelaide.
Now that's life, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In every
no one says you should stay there because they're your mates.
No, no.
And so it just becomes acceptable the older you get, or more acceptable.
Yeah, it does.
So what I would say is that the younger the kids are and the more they actually get involved in high-performance programmes, not that you need to go too young, they ought to try and maintain the link. Mm. And as you said earlier, these programs should be porous. People are coming in and out. And because they develop at different stages, people come in and start playing at different ages.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They do.
And they practice more. So they make rapid progress in a short space of time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Look, it seems to me, just following this thread just a little bit further, it just seems to me that this high-performance program we've got up to, essentially, to the age of 15, as it is at the moment, and then we've got other processes there. But this is a massive investment in football development.
Yeah.
Massive. These handout points we're talking about, like, some will go to ACTAS, and that commitment to ACTAS is a big one.
Mm.
A big one, and should be taken very seriously.
Absolutely.
And you know, we're talking about some very serious training going on there, because the pencil is now sharpening on that pathway.
Yep.
Get to the AIS, you really got to be thinking about wanting to be a serious footballer, or you know, you need to hand your spot over to someone else.
Yeah.
But if you don't go down that pathway, Ron, then the Premier League clubs then have to deliver themselves, because we've got Youth League teams, everyone's scouting, as you say, for players.
Yeah.
And suddenly they emerge. They'll get trials. There are other avenues now in a more formal sense. And you're quite right. If you get picked off at another echelon, you might move into state.
That's happened.
Premier League at New South Wales. Well, you're getting a bit closer again if that's what you want.
Absolutely.
You don't sit back and say, well, I got the offer, but, you know, gee, I could have been a world champion. Isn't that the cry? Yeah. Only going to find out if you try.
Absolutely. And the thing is, I think people, when these programs are offered to young people at any sport, that's crunch time.
It is.
It's like saying, well, do I really want to get serious?
You have been listening to the Near Post Local, and we have been speaking to football sage Ron Smith about his current mission, to review the Capital Football High Performance Program. Well, that's it for the Near Post Local. If you want this podcast, go to www.nearpostlocal.blogspot.com. You'll find a lot of other interesting materials around football there for your consumption. Enjoy your football and futsal. See you next time. Ta-da. Make my